games. So were Lewis's young men. In addition, Lewis had the problem of idle hands. Like most company commanders with that problem, he turned to athletics as a way to keep up morale and strength and reach out to the natives. The result was a tournament. There was a shooting match, which Lewis won with two hits of a mark at a distance of 220 yards, something even more impressive to the Indians than his air gun. On horseback, the Nez Perce put the American soldiers to shame. Lewis was amazed at how accurate they were with the arrow, even when firing at a rolling target from the back of a galloping horse. There were frequent horse races among the Indians or between Indians and whites. Lewis remarked, "Several of those horses would be thought fleet in the United States." The Indians could do feats that the whites could only watch. "It is astonishing," Lewis wrote, "to see these people ride down those steep hills, which they do at full speed." The stallions in the expedition's herd were so troublesome, the captains offered to trade two of them for one of the Indians' geldings. The Indians refused. The captains decided they would have to take the risk of castration and began the operation. A young man interrupted to show the whites how the Indians did it. His method was to let the wound bleed rather than tying off the scrotum. As an experiment, the captains had him operate on two stallions in the Indian way, while Driard gelded two in the white way. 2 weeks later, Lewis wrote, "I have no hesitation in declaring my belief that the Indian method of gelding is preferable to that practiced by ourselves." Horse care, horse trading, horse racing brought the white and red men together. On the evening of May 13th, "We tried the speed of several of our horses in races against one another and Indians. It is an irresistible scene. The young braves, red and white, racing from point to point over that beautiful valley with the snow-topped mountains looming behind, whooping and whipping their horses, digging in their heels, while crowds of onlookers, also mounted and also a mix of red and white, cheered them on. Wherever one looked, there were horses, Appaloosas mostly, selectively bred, active, strong, and well-formed, according to Lewis. They were present in immense numbers, a phrase Lewis hadn't used to describe a herd of animals since he left the buffalo country. 50, 60, or 100 head is not unusual for an individual to possess. That herd was by far the Nez Perce's greatest asset. It also represented a potential solution to one of the major transportation problems facing the proposed American trading empire stretching from St. Louis to the mouth of the Columbia. The trick would be to get the Nez Perce herd over to the other side of the mountains, which in turn depended on making a peace between the Blackfeet and the Nez Perce, which was hardly likely as long as the Blackfeet had guns and the Nez Perce did not. Still, Lewis was resolved to try. As he gazed at the magnificent herd, he began to imagine two long strings of Indian pack horses passing each other on this prairie. One was headed east, carrying spices and other fabulous goods from the Indies. The other headed west, carrying furs from the Missouri River country and trade goods from Europe. In the image, Nez Perce horses would make up for the lack of an all-water route across the continent. It was an idea Lewis had started working on back at Fort Clatsop. His first attempts to begin creating the conditions that would make the plan workable had failed. He couldn't get a Nez Perce delegate to go with him to meet with the Blackfeet, or a chief to come to Washington with him. But he stayed with the idea and continued to try to think it through. There were frequent foot races. Lewis was impressed by one Indian who proved to be as fleet as the expedition's best runners, Driard and Reuben Field. There were games of prison base, an Indian game in which each side tries to make prisoners of those who run out of their base area, and pitching quoits, a white man's game of throwing flattened rings at a pin. Lewis encouraged the games, for they gave the men who were not hunters some badly needed exercise. "They have had so little to do that they are getting rather lazy and slothful." Mainly what they did was look at the bitterroots to see how much snow was left. The expedition's energy was as tight as a coiled spring, ready to vault itself over those mountains in an agony of anticipation of being released. Waiting for snow to melt is rather like watching grass grow. The first discernible sign of progress is greeted with the greatest joy. Thus Lewis on May 17th. "I am pleased at finding the river rise so rapidly. It no doubt is attributable to the melting snows of the mountains." Still, they had to wait. the mountains remained. That icy barrier which separates me from my friends and country, from all which makes life esteemable. Patience, patience, Lewis advised himself as he concluded his journal entry and closed the elkskin-covered volume. Not until May 26 did he let a little optimism into his journal. The river still rising fast and snows of the mountains visibly diminish, he wrote. Ethnography and nature studies helped him get his mind off the snow. On May 27th, one of the men brought him a black woodpecker, which Lewis had already seen and noted but not held in his hand. He now gave it a 500-word description. The throat is of a fine crimson red, the belly and breast is a curious mixture of white and blood red, wings and tail are of a sooty black, top of the head black, with a glossy tint of green in a certain exposure, and so on. The bird is now named Lewis's woodpecker. Lewis preserved the skin, which ended up at Harvard University. It is his only surviving zoological specimen. On June 6th, we meet with a beautiful little bird, also described in charming detail. It was the western tanager. Lewis also collected, described, and preserved close to 50 new plants, including camas, yellow bells, Lewis's syringa, purple trillium, ragged robin, and Mariposa lily. Paul Cutright calls this his most productive period as a botanist. Every day, the Nez Perce told the captains they would have to wait. As May turned into June, the waiting got harder. Twisted Hare had told them that the tribe would cross the mountains in May, but that was before the winter snows began. It had snowed and snowed and snowed, far beyond an average year, to such an extent that some of the Indians were warning the captains they would have to wait until July. But on June 3rd, Lewis was surprised and pleased to learn that today the Indians dispatched an express over the mountains to Traveler's Rest. The express was a teenage boy who went seeking information from the Flatheads about the occurrences that have taken place on the east side of the mountains during the winter. If the Indians could send a boy over the Lolo Trail just to pick up some gossip, Lewis thought it probable that we could also pass. He told the Nez Perce he was going to try, but they replied that, although their boys could make the trip, Lewis's men could not. The creeks were too high, there was no grass, and the snow was deep over the roads, which were extremely slippery. They told Lewis to have patience. In 12 to 14 days, he could set out. On June 4th, Lewis met with some of the chiefs. He repeated his request for guides to accompany his party to the falls of the Missouri, then up to the Blackfoot country in search of a truce. The chief stalled. Lewis checked the men's packs and was pleased to find that our whole party have an ample store of bread and roots for our voyage. All around the campsite, the men were much engaged in preparing their saddles, arranging their loads, provisions, etc., for our departure. The captains planned to move camp eastward from the banks of the Clearwater to higher ground at the western terminus of the Lolo Trail on the southern end of Weipe Prairie, where they had first met the Nez Perce the preceding September. There they would make camp and begin the final preparations for the assault on the mountains. On June 8th, 2 days before the move, there was a sort of farewell party at the campsite they had occupied on the banks of the Clearwater for nearly a month. The afternoon featured horse and foot racing and game playing. In the evening, Crouzot brought out the fiddle and dancing began. But as the festivities went on, an Indian told the captains that the snow was still deep and they would not be able to cross until the beginning of July. He warned that if they tried it sooner, the horses would be at least 3 days without food. "This information is disagreeable," Lewis admitted. "It causes some doubt as to the time at which it will be most proper for us to set out," but not enough doubt to deter the captains. Lewis explained, "As we have no time to lose, we will risk the chances and set out as early as the Indians generally think it practicable, or the middle of this month." By midday June 9th, everything was in readiness for the move to White Prairie. The mood was exuberant. "Our party seemed much elated with the idea of moving on towards their friends and country," Lewis happily noted. "They all seem alert in their movements today." Notwithstanding the thoughts of what lay ahead, they were amusing themselves very merrily today in running foot races, pitching quoits, prison base, etc. The expedition was about to resume its march. Chapter 28. The Lolo Trail, June 10th to July 2nd, 1806. On the morning of June 10th, just before the expedition set off for White Prairie, Cottonose sent word that two of his young men would overtake the party in a day or so, guide it through the mountains, then lead Lewis to the falls of the Missouri. Welcome news, the best possible. The party moved out in high spirits. Each man, and presumably Sacagawea, was mounted and leading a pack horse. In addition, there were several spare horses. "We therefore feel ourselves perfectly equipped for the mountains," Lewis wrote. He established camp at the Quamash Flats. Quamash was Camas, the route that had stood off starvation for the men in September, and then damn near killed them. Stomachs had adjusted. The men could eat it now without violent consequences. The plant was so central to the lives of the Nez Perce that Lewis wrote a 1,500-word description of camas and the Indian methods of preparing it for food. His concluding sentence was, "This root is palatable, but disagrees with me in every shape I have ever used it." He enjoyed its appearance. The Quamash is now in bloom, and from the color of its bloom at a short distance it resembles lakes of fine clear water. So complete is this deception that on first sight I could have sworn it was water. By June 13th, the pressure on the captains, from both within and without, to get going was all but irresistible. But Cutnose's young men had not shown up. Lewis gave them one more day. Meanwhile, he sent two hunters ahead to a prairie 8 miles east to lay in a stock of meat. The Indians did not show that day or the next, and Lewis gave up on the guides. On the evening of June 14th, he ordered the horses hobbled in anticipation of an early start. "From hence to Traveler's Rest," Lewis wrote that night, "we shall make a forced march." With the decision to go without guides, Lewis had allowed impatience to cloud his judgment. He was taking chances and violating Jefferson's orders to be always prudent so that he could carry out his number one objective to get to the Pacific and back with a report on the main features of the country. And for what was he taking such a risk? To get home a little earlier? If the expedition could get to Traveler's Rest by early August, and if it then took the Nez Perce route to the Buffalo Country, it would be at Great Falls by the middle of August. There it could dig up its caches and then speed downstream with 2 good traveling months to get to St. Louis. But Lewis felt a pressing need to get going. Besides just giving in to impatience, he had some genuine objectives in mind, primarily further exploring. He and Clark had agreed to divide at Traveler's Rest. Clark would go to the Jefferson River and on to Three Forks, where he would cross to the Yellowstone Valley and proceed down the Yellowstone to the Missouri, mapping and describing new country every step of the way. Lewis would follow the Nez Perce Buffalo route to Great Falls, then conduct an exploration of the Marias River to its sources. He hoped that those sources would be well north of 49 degrees. That would be good news to bring to the president. To make these side explorations, the captains needed to get over the mountains by the beginning of July. That was why Lewis felt time pressing. But, although the expeditions to the Marias and the Yellowstone were interesting and important, they were not significant enough to merit risking everything. Lewis's usual good judgment had left him. Previously, he had made his decisions on the basis of what needed to be done next to make the expedition succeed, not what might be done in 2 months if such or so were done now. Previously, he had been a mature, responsible senior commander, except with the Sioux, where he had allowed himself to be provoked into taking excess risks. Now he was an impatient junior officer acting more on impulse than on judgment. He had always been self-confident. Now he was cocksure. He remarked at Lemhi Pass in 1805 that anything Indians could do, he and his men could do. Even after seeing the Clatsops and Chinooks in their canoes, after seeing the Nez Perce ride their horses, he retained that notion of white superiority. Even when the Indian boy who set out to cross the mountains a couple of weeks earlier showed up to report that he had been forced back by the heavy snow, Lewis insisted on going. The Nez Perce told him it couldn't be done. At first, he discounted them. Eventually, he ignored them. He proposed to be the first to cross the Lolo Trail in 1806 and without guides. In his journal on June 14th, Lewis admitted to apprehension. the snow and the lack of grass for the horses, will prove a serious embarrassment to us, as at least 4 days' journey of our route in these mountains lies over heights and along a ledge of mountains never entirely destitute of snow. Clark wrote that evening, "Even now I shudder with the expectation with great difficulties in passing those mountains." Lewis rationalized the decision. "We have now been detained near 5 weeks in consequence of the snows," he wrote, "a serious loss of time at this delightful season for traveling." Whatever the risk and apprehension, there is no doubt the decision to move out was a popular one. "Everybody seems anxious to be in motion," Lewis wrote, "convinced that we have not now any time to delay, if the calculation is to reach the United States this season. This I am determined to accomplish, if within the compass of human power." On the morning of June 15th, in a cold, driving rain, the party set out. At 8 miles, they found 2 deer the hunters had killed and hung. At noon, they halted at a creek and dined while the horses grazed. Through the afternoon, they marched. The going was difficult because of fallen timber crisscrossing the trail and the slippery pathway caused by the rain. Still, they made 22 miles. Lewis did a bird count and found a hummingbird nest. So far, so good. No snow yet, so the trail was easy to follow. June 16th, an early start. The party ascended a ridge and nooned it at a handsome little glade where there was grass for the horses. The glade was bursting with life. Lewis noted the dog-tooth violet, the bluebells, the yellow flowering pea, and the columbine in bloom, and the honeysuckle, huckleberry, and white maple putting out their first leaves, along with other signs of spring in the mountains. But within a couple of hours of resuming the march, the party found itself in winter conditions. The snow was 8 to 10 feet deep. Fortunately, it was firm enough to bear the horses. Indeed, it improved the traveling, for it covered the fallen timber, but it also covered the trail. They made 15 miles during the day and camped at the small glade where Captain Clark had killed a horse the previous September and hung it for Lewis and his men. There was insufficient grass for the horses, and it was obvious that as they continued to gain altitude, there would be even less grass. In the morning, the going was difficult and dangerous. The climb toward the ridge was steep, the elevation gain dramatic. After 3 miles of climbing, "We found ourselves enveloped in snow from 12 to 15 feet deep, even on the south sides of the hills, with the fairest exposure to the sun." Lewis thought he had prepared himself for the worst, but he hadn't. "Here was winter with all its rigors," he wrote that evening. The party was 6 or 7 days' march from Traveler's Rest, provided it was fortunate enough not to lose the way, and of this, Driard, our principal dependence as a woodsman and guide, was entirely doubtful. In an analysis that would have been better written 5 days earlier, Lewis admitted, "If we proceeded and should get bewildered in these mountains, the certainty was that we should lose all our horses and consequently our baggage, instruments, perhaps our papers, and thus eminently risk the loss of the discoveries which we had already made if we should be so fortunate as to escape with life." He consulted with Clark. They reached an obvious conclusion. "We conceived it madness in this stage of the expedition to proceed without a guide." This led to a resolution. "To return with our horses while they were yet strong, to an encampment with sufficient grass. Driard and Private Shannon would hurry on back to the Nez Perce villages to hire a guide. The party would wait for them and subsist on hunting, preserving their roots." That resolution made, "We ordered the party to make a deposit for all the baggage which we had not immediate use for." In the deposit, the men put the roots they had brought, depending on the hunters for the next few days for food. In addition, Lewis put in the instruments and journals. The journals were by far the most precious of all the expedition's possessions. The reason Lewis left them in the deposit illuminates what a risk he had taken in starting too soon. He wrote that they are safer here than to risk them on horseback over the roads and creeks which we had passed. The deposit was laid on scaffolds and well covered. At 1 o'clock p.m., the party started down the mountain. Lewis hated to turn around. So did the men. "The party were a good deal dejected," Lewis wrote. This is the first time since we have been on this long tour that we have been compelled to retreat or make a retrograde march. Sergeant Gass added that most of the men were melancholy and disappointed. On June 18th, Driard and Shannon struck out for the village to procure a guide. The price Lewis was ready to pay for a guide was unprecedented. He gave Driard an army rifle to be offered as reward for leading the party to Traveler's Rest, and authorized him to promise 2 additional army rifles and 10 horses to any man who would lead the party to the falls of the Missouri. The next morning, the party made camp in a meadow on the edge of the mountains. There was plenty of grass. The horses could fatten up here while the men waited for a guide. One of the men found some black morel mushrooms, which Lewis roasted and ate without salt, pepper, or grease. In this way, I had for the first time the true taste of the morel, which is truly an insipid, tasteless food. On neither that day nor the next 2 was there any sign of Driard and Shannon. The captains worried about them and talked about what they would do if they couldn't get a guide. The plan they agreed on showed the depth of their desperation. We have determined to risk a passage without a guide, Lewis wrote. Captain C, or myself, shall take 4 of our most expert woodsmen, with 3 or 4 of our best horses, and proceed 2 days in advance, taking a plentiful supply of provision. The party would find the Lolo Trail by the marks on the sides of the pine trees, marks made over the decades by Indian horses and baggage.